You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 22nd of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. It is 1600 in Yerevan, 1300 in Paris, midday here in London and 8 a.m. in New York. You're listening to Monocle Radio. The Briefing starts now. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Chris Chermak. Coming up on today's programme. India's election is off to an auspicious start with the arrest of a major opposition leader. We'll examine the fallout. After that, we look at Armenia's efforts to cozy up to the West. We'll head to a European aviation conference and then...
They live their issue. They are very, very authentic. And this is much easier to do on the local level than on the federal level.
Monocle's Alexei Korolev speaks to those on the ground about whether the Communist Party could soon take over the Austrian city of Salzburg. And finally, we'll look at the legacy of Karl Lagerfeld and the sale of his last apartment in Paris. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Chermak. Earlier this week, we covered the announced start of India's elections in April. It will be the world's largest democratic experiment. And already at the end of this week, there's been a twist with the arrest of one of the main opposition's leaders in Delhi Chief Minister Arvind Kejriwal over charges of corruption. Prime Minister Narendra Modi's party has denied opposition accusations that the arrest was politically motivated. But here to tell us whether that's accurate or not is Maya Sharma, journalist in New Delhi. Maya, thanks very much for coming on the program again. Tell us, first of all, what we know about these charges.
Well, the arrest of a sitting chief minister is a huge bit of news here in India, of course, with less than a month to go for voting to start in the big Lok Sabha general elections. What the allegation against Arvind Kejriwal is that his party, the Aam Aadmi Party, that he himself and some other leaders took massive kickbacks, running into the millions of rupees, massive kickbacks to allot certain parts of New Delhi city in terms of under a new liquor policy, which they had introduced. And they said the people that they favored by actually allotting some of these districts in Delhi paid them this huge sum of money. Now, the investigation has been going on for a couple of years. The deputy chief minister was arrested a year ago. Other ministers have been arrested as well. And Kejriwal himself had been issued summons by the enforcement directorate to appear. Summons he absolutely refused to actually follow. He did not appear before the enforcement directorate. And he was arrested late last night, very dramatically. First time, really, that the sitting chief minister has been arrested like this. And the complication, of course, is that the opposition insists that the enforcement directorate, which arrested him, and other wings of the government, like the income tax department and the CBI, the Central Bureau of Investigation, they claim that they're operating under government directives in terms of the BJP. They say they're just doing the BJP's work and targeting opposition leaders.
And what can you tell us about, I mean, it's tricky, of course, but whether those kinds of allegations are accurate? Perhaps one way to ask it is simply how independent typically is India's judiciary and also those federal agencies that would have charged Kejriwal and have been going after him, as you say, for quite a while now. Do we have any sense in that sense of just, you know, how accurate these charges are?
That put me on the spot. Why don't you? Well, of course, the opposition insists that these agencies are run at the behest of the ruling party, that the BJP has absolute control over who is investigated and when. The opposition has actually united in this case as well. We've got chief ministers from opposition parties condemning the arrest. We've got the Congress's Rahul Gandhi calling the family members of Arvind Kejriwal. Mamata Banerjee, another major opposition leader of the TMC, calling the family as well. So it'll be interesting to see if this act has actually united the opposition. They have, of course, the India Bloc, which is an opposition to the BJP. But even the opposition leaders who are objecting are not saying that they are against investigation of corruption. That is not what they're saying. They're talking about the timing of it. The arrest of a major opposition leader with just weeks to go before the election. They're talking about the timing. especially when this investigation has been going on for some years. And this also follows a very recent freezing of the accounts of the Congress Party itself, based on allegations of income tax irregularities, which date back to the 1990s. Like, some of these allegations date back to the 1990s, and their accounts have been frozen this week, again, just weeks ahead of the election. So the opposition thinks this is the BJP playing dirty and making sure it's not a level playing field as the elections approach.
So perhaps then, and not so much to put you on the spot, but to take it back a little bit, I just wonder if you could put it into context for us to what extent this has happened in the past in India. Is there a way we can sort of gauge from that as well, you know, how common this is, whether corruption is generally an issue that is often targeted or needs to be targeted, versus whether there's been a lot of, you know, attempts to arrest opposition leaders or figures at inappropriate times, shall we say?
Well, I think there has certainly been an increase in the arrest of opposition leaders at inappropriate times. I think that has certainly increased over the last few years under the BJP government. Arvind Kejriwal himself, ironically, rose to national fame on an anti-corruption plank. He, along with a man called Anna Hazare, actually led this anti-corruption campaign across India. So very, very strange that he's being arrested now on these corruption charges. His former mentor, Anna Hazare, has also criticized Arvind Kejriwal as well. But corruption is unfortunately a reality in India at all levels. Many times, opposition leaders have been arrested also these awkward times. That is not to say that they are not guilty of corruption. I think what people are objecting to is the timing of it, Unfortunately, corruption is a given in many areas in India. That is the sad truth. But the timing of it in the run-up to the election, trying to lock away opposition leaders and also to freeze the accounts of the major Congress opposition party, people are really questioning that.
And what kind of impact do you think it will then have on this election? I mean, when we last spoke, we were basically talking about Narendra Modi's popularity, the fact that he was pretty much going to, or his party was pretty much going to run away with this election anyway. But then at the same time, when you speak of this arrest, you suggest that the opposition might rally around this. I mean, you could make an argument sort of why would Narendra Modi's party be stirring the pot at this situation? Is this something that almost might backfire on them if they were involved, or whether they're involved or not?
Well, the opposition certainly hopes that this is a turning point. If you look at social media also, there are lots of people saying this is the turning point, that people will realize what is happening. And the opposition also says this points to a certain level of insecurity of the BJP. The BJP is saying they will definitely win more than 400 seats in the parliament. They're talking about that. And the question is, of course, like, if they are so sure, and if they are indeed directing these agencies to go after the opposition, why? Why bother if they are absolutely so confident? But if this is really going to be a turning point, it needs to be, that's what the opposition hopes, shall we say. There's no guarantee of this at all, because unfortunately, corruption is not as huge an issue as it should be in the minds of the electorate of India. It should be, but it really isn't. So whether this will serve to bring the opposition together and actually help them win more seats, well, of course, we'll know on June the 4th. That is what the opposition hopes. The BJP thinks that it can get away with this and make things maybe a little easier for them when the elections come around.
Thanks very much, Maya. That was Maya Sharma. Now here's Paige Reynolds with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Chris. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Israel ahead of a UN vote on a US draft resolution which supports calls for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. It is the first time the US has supported calls for an immediate ceasefire in the region, having previously blocked such demands at the UN. The ceasefire deal is tied to the release of hostages held by Hamas. Pressure is mounting on Ukraine to dismantle its so-called Sponsors of War blacklist. The list has no legal standing, but singles out around 50 major companies for operating in Russia. It's believed the list could be dismantled after Austria, China, France and Hungary had all exerted pressure on Kyiv. And Luis Montenegro has been named as Portugal's Prime Minister. The centre-right leader of the Democratic Alliance Party was named by the country's president yesterday. He succeeds Antonio Costa, who had been in office since 2015 and who resigned last year over allegations of corruption. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks very much, Paige. Armenia has confirmed that its Prime Minister, Nikol Pashinyan, will be heading to Brussels at the start of next month for a pretty high-stakes meeting with European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen and US Secretary of State Antony Blinken. It is part of a pivot to the west by Armenia, which has been warning that another war with neighbouring Azerbaijan could be on the cards. Richard Girigosian, director of the Regional Studies Center, a think tank in Yerevan, Armenia, joins me now on the line. Richard, thanks very much for coming on the show. Let's start with what Armenia wants from the US and the European Union, and what can it expect?
Well, on the one hand, Armenia is simply looking for the basic minimum in security, given the constant and consistent threats from neighboring Azerbaijan. What we should expect, however, is a Western embrace of Armenia's commitment to democracy and a deepening of reform. So this meeting is both significant, but also only the latest in a series of Armenia's move westward.
Does that mean, are you suggesting there would be sort of conditions attached to security? Is that fair to say that the US and EU would push for, say, reforms within Armenia in order to offer some sort of security guarantees?
Actually, no, just the opposite. It's not a condition, but a reward for the pre-existing commitment to democracy in Armenia. And it stems from the 2018 rare victory of nonviolent people power in Armenia. Having said that, what we see going forward, however, is a need to end the war from 2020, where Azerbaijan's territorial ambitions against Armenia remain a lingering threat.
Tell us more about the state of that at the moment. I mean, Azerbaijan basically took over Nagorno-Karabakh, so one could say, for better or worse, that aspect of the conflict is settled. But what is the danger of an even wider war here?
Well, the real danger is the much broader threat to undermine Western values. What I'm specifically referring to is Azerbaijan's military victory against Armenia, its ethnic cleansing against the Armenians of Nagorno-Karabakh, pose a very challenging and distressing precedent where the use of force has been validated over diplomacy, and it was very much a victory of authoritarian power over struggling democracies.
And what is your sense of kind of how the U.S. and the European Union have reacted to this in the past, and I guess just how much they really would want to get involved? There are, you know, to be perfectly honest, of course, there are so many conflicts at the moment that the U.S. and European Union are involved in. What can we expect them to really do to help Armenia?
Well, it's actually the European Union that can offer much more to Armenia. It is the EU that has already deployed civilian monitors to the country, and it's the European Union that is much closer. Armenia as well is much closer to European interests than it is to, say, U.S. national security. Nevertheless, I do think EU engagement has been effective and successful because they're not seeking to mediate. They're seeking rather to facilitate post-war negotiations and diplomacy between Armenia and Azerbaijan.
Well, speaking of mediation, I do also have to ask how Russia figures into this. They were at one point the sort of mediators between Armenia and Azerbaijan. They also had peacekeepers in the region, but then, well, frankly, seemed to either lose interest or kind of side with Azerbaijan, or at least allow this invasion of Nagorno-Karabakh to happen. It's not really like them necessarily to let a conflict simmer on their border. I wonder what you feel like their role is at the moment.
Well, I think timing is crucial. Russia remains distracted and overwhelmed by its failed invasion of Ukraine and Russian complicity in allowing Azerbaijan's military takeover of Nagorno-Karabakh, will, over the long term, undermine Russian position and power. This has also driven Armenia much further away from Russia. And what Armenia is now seeking as a struggling democracy is to escape the Russian orbit.
Is that going to be as easy as you suggest there, of simply trying to escape the Russian orbit? Or do you imagine that either now or at some point in the future, when Russia is less preoccupied, that they could get back involved and try and pull Armenia back into the fold?
Well, I do see a storm on the horizon where, no matter what happens on the Ukrainian battlefield, all of Russia's neighbors are going to face a vengeful, angry, isolated Putin. So I do think the threat is coming, but I do think this meeting and the reason we're talking today is this Western embrace of Armenia is no longer a policy of democracy promotion, but rather democracy protection.
Richard Girigosian, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio.
Download the latest episode of Meet the Writers to join me, Georgina Godwin, as I talk to Helen Russell. After leaving a successful media career in London and relocating to Denmark, she published her international bestseller, The Year of Living Danishly, uncovering the secrets of the world's happiest country. And now she's back with How to Raise a Viking, which uncovers the secrets to parenting the world's happiest children. That's Helen Russell on Meet the Writers, available as a podcast now.
Over the last few days, Europe's aviation industry has been convening at their annual Airlines for Europe Summit. It is a chance for airlines, big and small, to set priorities in a pretty difficult environment at the moment, particularly with Boeing's ongoing troubles still working their way through the sector, and also pressure to make flying more sustainable. Well, Lewis Harper is the business airline editor at Flight Global. He was there and he joins us now here. Lewis, This sort of summit included major airline groups as well as low-cost airline groups. They can often be at odds with each other, so I wonder what they sort of agreed on.
Yeah, it's very true. It's quite unusual. You see, so the CEO of EasyJet standing next to the CEO of Ryanair, you know, CEOs of Lufthansa Group, IAG, who own BA and Iberia, and Air France, KLM, all standing next to each other. And as you say, you know, normal day-to-day operations, they're quite often quite aggressively competing on routes and generally, whether that's locally in Europe or internationally. So there is, A4E as an organisation is very focused, and it's no coincidence that the event takes place in the shadow of the European Parliament. So it's very focused on certain policy and regulatory areas where they can kind of stand up and agree, whether that is, you know, as you mentioned, the huge sustainability challenge the industry has, issues around airspace, and generally talking about a level playing field for Europe's airlines. So despite, you know, what it may look like, they do have areas where they agree. Tracks do show when they're, even when they're talking about them. But yes, there are areas where they can have one voice.
Well, and tell us more about the sustainability issue in particular. There are various ways being discussed at the moment to make aviation more sustainable. What can you tell us about what the airlines themselves want, which of course isn't always, you know, what European politicians will agree on?
No, and when you talk about areas where the politicians disagree, it's the airline industry has long wanted a single European sky to be to happen, essentially breaking down what are currently national barriers in air traffic control, which mean routings when you're flying across Europe are broken up and aren't necessarily straight lines, to put it in the most simple way. And they believe that if Europe achieved that, that could achieve a 10% fuel saving. I think there's a recognition that because of national security concerns, I think it's still a bit of a pipe dream there. So, but they do continue to push for that, other airspace reforms as well. But I think sustainable aviation fuel is the thing that's really driving the net zero mission for all airlines really looking towards that 2050 net zero target. And what they want from European policymakers really is the development of a domestic sustainable aviation fuel production industry. It's tiny at the moment. Airlines say they're buying everything that's available. It's very expensive because there's no economy of scale. So they really want that. There's a recognition that from the politicians that they want it as well. But the gap, you know, European airlines are meant to have 6% of their fuel usage as SAF by 2030. At the moment, there aren't many people who can see that happening because, you know, simply isn't the production, and it takes 5-6 years to build a plant. So that is probably the most important area, I think, for the airlines in Europe at the moment.
And to what extent was aviation safety a topic? We've talked a lot on this show and across our shows about the ramifications of Boeing's troubles. I imagine this puts airline CEOs into really a pretty tricky position, because on the one hand, they want to assure the public that their planes are safe. On the other hand, they do want to get some answers from the likes of Boeing.
Absolutely. You've hit the nail on the head there. I think it is awkward because, you know, on the one hand, as you say, all of the CEOs will say that the aircraft they're operating, whether they're 737 Maxes, whether they're A320neos, whatever, from Airbus and Boeing, are safe. Mm-hmm. They have 100% confidence in them. And, you know, we know the fact is the airline industry last year had one of its safest years ever. There were no fatal crashes involving jet aircraft across millions of flights. So there is evidence to point to that while there are these issues, that, you know, it's not unreasonable to say that flying is still very safe. But as you say, there are very specific issues at the moment. On the Airbus side, we know there are issues with the Pratt & Whitney engines, which is causing a lot of groundings in Europe, certainly through this summer. But I think the core one, as you say, is Boeing. And it's quite rare for Boeing to have a good week at the moment. And Michael O'Leary of Ryanair, they're one of the biggest MAX customers in the world. They've got about 130 MAX aircraft at the moment. They're taking lots more. They're not getting as many as they want. And I think, you know, there was some pretty strong criticism from Michael O'Leary for Boeing during the event.
Yeah, not him and others as well, certainly. Lewis Harper, thank you very much for joining us. You are with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. This is The Briefing, and I'm Chris Chermak. Earlier this month in Austria, it was the unlikely duo of Social Democrats and Communists who topped a municipal election in the city of Salzburg, famous for being the birthplace of Mozart and the setting for the hit musical Sound of Music, not to mention the birthplace of my father. A runoff between the two red parties has been scheduled for this Sunday to decide whether Austria gets a second communist-run city following the party's takeover of Graz in 2021. Monocle's Alexei Korolev meets the communist hopefuls.
My name is Kai-Michael Danke. I am a historian. I originally was more interested in the global economic crisis of the late 2000s, and that gradually brought me closer to a critical view upon the world.
Kai-Michael Danke hardly fits the stereotype of a communist leader. A soft-spoken historian, he's more akin to mid-20th century leftist intellectuals than to the Soviet Politburo. He also enjoys making sandcastles on the beach.
That is correct. Unusually, I spend an absurd amount of time in creating them, so 5, 6, 7 hours, and usually they're quite huge.
The Communist Party of Austria, or KPÖ, is the oldest continuously operating political party in the country. Despite this, it's never been a major national force, but on the local level, it's managed some impressive feats. In 2021, the KPÖ claimed Austria's second city of Graz, and this weekend, Kai-Michael Dankl may do the same in Salzburg.
As a historian, I usually deal more with the past than the future, so I am hesitant to give any forecasts about the upcoming Sunday, but I think everything is possible.
As in Graz, the KPÖ's success in Salzburg has been down to one crucial issue.
Yes, we do focus on the key issue of affordable housing. While Vienna already 100 years ago in the 1920s started to invest quite heavily in building public housing, Salzburg doesn't have a lot of that. In Salzburg, with 160,000 inhabitants in the city, we have a total of about 80,000 buildings that are used to house people. And of that, only a quarter is non-profit rent housing. In other cities like Linz or Graz, this portion is much higher. So Salzburg is really quite behind when it comes to investing as a city in affordable housing.
Of course, it's a signal, it's a symbol, the same symbol like LKK was in Graz, because she's also communist mayor.
Peter Hayek is a respected Austrian political analyst and pollster. One of his recent studies found that a third of Austrians now consider the KPÖ ready for national government.
One third said yes, but 8% of this one third, they said yes, of course, definitely. And the other 25% said yes, okay. You know, and that's a big difference. So one of 10, they think, yes, they will do it perfectly. The other one will say, yes, give them a chance.
Hmm. Why is it that the communists are so successful on the local level, but never on the federal level?
Because, first of all, it's the candidate. Kai Michael Dankl has a lot of advantages. First of all, he's the nice guy. He's well-educated, and he's a real great communicator. And the second point is, it's the issue housing. And they started this issue in the 90s. So they are real experts in housing, and they live their issue. They are very, very authentic with this issue. And that's the big success. And this is much easier to do on the local level than on the federal level.
Kai Michael Dankl's opponent this Sunday is another Red, a social democrat who has run for Salzburg mayor twice before. Whichever way the vote goes, the two men will need to work together. And Kai Michael Dankl says they will.
Definitely. I think a lot of people have the justified expectation that there's a cooperation and a spirit of good cooperation across party borders. So I'm a bit optimistic for the future, but of course it's something that you need to strive for every day.
For Monocle, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Alexei Korolev in Vienna there. Thank you very much. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. And finally on today's show, if you have just a little bit of spare cash on hand, you might be interested in bidding for the last apartment of Karl Lagerfeld. It is on the Left Bank in Paris, estimated price tag a cool 5.3 million euros. And it's also part of a trend that's being called collector's real estate. Personally, I'm going to aim a little lower for collector's items, but it's good for some. Joining us for more is the journalist and author of Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes, Dana Thomas. Dana, always good to have you on the show. You have been to this apartment. Let's start there. What's it like?
I have. I visited it last week. And it's a funny thing. You know, it's on the Quai Voltaire in one of the oldest buildings in Paris. It dates to 1694. And Carl bought the apartment about 20 years ago. And he decided he didn't want an apartment from 1694. He wanted an apartment from 2004 or 2024. So he gutted the place, took out all the moldings and the boiserie and the beautiful parquet. He poured this concrete floor that's mixed with resin, so it's shiny gray. He covered the walls with sandblasted, frosted glass partitions and like that are on levers that like that close and open, framed the whole thing in that with a bluish light that doesn't create shadows. He even used that frosted glass as shutters along the river Seine of the view, the magnificent view. He closed it in a way So he could see, he had this glass made so he could see through it, but nobody could see in and see him, which is very James Bond. And it does actually feel rather like a James Bond lair. And he only used it for working. He didn't live there. He had his assistant who looked after his cat Choupette lived there, and Choupette had a little niche where her bed was. And there was a kitchen that only has a refrigerator. It was only used the kitchen to keep his Diet Coke cold, and nothing was ever cooked in the apartment. And he had a dressing room where he could change his outfit before going out. And he had a bathtub and a shower. And that was it. It's a funny place. He took a 5-bedroom apartment, turned it into this sort of working studio lair, and with super modern 21st century furniture, which has since been sold. And it's on the market now. You can buy it.
And how much did this apartment, I guess, reflect the personality of Karl Lagerfeld himself? Or was he kind of just having a bit of fun here compared to some of his other places?
Well, you know, Karl was a man of like mega ideas all the time. He was one of the few people as a journalist that when I ever interviewed him, I recorded him. I'm an old school journalist where I take a notebook and I take notes. I could not take notes with Karl Lagerfeld. He talked too fast. He was, as they said in Seinfeld, a fast talker. And he was a fast thinker, and he drank 24 Diet Cokes a day or something. So he's a little strung out, but he had all these houses and he loved just collecting houses. He was a collector of real estate along with many other things. And each one was completely different from the other. He had a beautiful villa that he leased from Monaco that sat out on a point, and he did up like the 17th century. He had another place he had done up in Deco. He was restoring a beautiful chateau outside of Paris in Lucienne for 4 years. He lived in a 17th century apartment on the UK, on the Rue de l'Université. He really did mix things up. He loved collecting Memphis, which was the 1980s design. So he had a lot of properties, so many that Thames and Hudson put out a book last year called Karl Lagerfeld, A Life in Houses. And in this book is the K. Voltaire apartment.
So who is going to potentially replace him? I mean, what do you make of this collector's trend, as it were? Is there somebody else out there that is trying to do the same thing, either snap up all of his properties or in general, just this sort of collector's real estate trend? It is good if you have the money.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I imagine they're going to want to get it really quickly because, of course, it has a view on the Seine, which means that you get to see the Olympics opening ceremony from your apartment. You have to wire more than, a million or 1.2, I think it was one-fifth, so 1.2 million euros to an account, like an escrow account, just to show that you already have the money to at least put down a down payment. And it will be auctioned by the Paris Notaire Service in conjunction with an auction house called Altimis on Tuesday at 10 a.m. at the Chamber of Commerce and Industry at Place de la Bourse. They decided to do this rather than putting it on the market and just selling it because they thought that they would get a better price for it and it would just turn really quickly. They could sell it very quickly as opposed to letting it drag out. And you can bid by telephone or in person. They're going to do it old school, sort of like 17th or 18th century style, where they do it with a candle. I'm not quite sure how this works, but I got to go watch it, where they like light the candle and the bidding goes on till the candle burns out.
That's one way to do it.
And then if nobody has a winning bid or somebody has a top bid, then they light a second candle and you can outbid that person. It's a very funny old school way of doing things, which Karl would have loved. He would have so loved that.
I mean, flashbacks to the Pope and the election there or something along those lines.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, just finally, Dana, I mean, the fascination with Karl Lagerfeld and his life certainly continues also with the sale of this apartment. There is also a new series about him coming out called Becoming Karl Lagerfeld. What do we know about that?
Well, it's going to be, curiously, it's going to be on Disney Plus. I guess the plus is the part that you go, okay. So, because, you know, it's about gay love affairs among fashion people, and that's not terribly Disney, but it's going to be on Disney Plus in June. It's a six episode series. It's set in 1972, and it's about how he wants to rise to become the Kaiser Karl that he became, and his relationship with Yves Saint Laurent, his rivalry with Yves Saint Laurent and Pierre Berger, and his relationship with a young French dandy named Jacques de Bachere, who I think tragically, he did die, and I think he might have died of AIDS, but I might be wrong there, but he did die young. And Carl was heartbroken ever after. And so it's going to be a dishy, it's based on a book by a French journalist named Raphael Baquet called Kaiser Carl, though it also sounds a lot like the book my friend Alicia Drake wrote called The Beautiful Fall. If you ever want to read a great book about Carl and Eve, that's the one. And it's going to be, you know, filled with lots of French actors, superstars, and it's going to be really dishy and fun. And it's on Disney Plus. Go figure.
There you go. Disney Plus, Kaiser Carl. Do be sure to check that out. That was Dana Thomas in Paris, and that's all the time we have for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Paige Reynolds. Our researcher was George Ruskin, and our studio manager was Lily Austin. The Briefing is back on Monday at the same time. I'm Chris Chermak, wishing you all a good weekend. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.